All right, so welcome to Math 581B, Algebraic Number Theory. Here's the syllabus. Alright, so I'm going to quickly go over the syllabus, and then we'll start talking about rings of integers of number fields. So, since everybody have a copy now, yes. Alright, so as you can tell, class meets Monday, Wednesday, Friday right here at 10:30. Also, my office for office hours is just around the corner, right over there in room C423. And my office hours are going to be Mondays, 2:30 to 4:30. So that will be convenient because, for example, homework is due on Wednesdays, so before homework is due. Evaluation, so the homework will count for 70% of the class, and then there will be a final project, which is 30%, and there are no exams, no midterm, no final, or anything like that. And I'll say more about how the homework will be graded later on, but I do have the first homework assignment here. So we can just start passing that around. We're not talking about it yet. And typically the homework will be assigned on Wednesday and then due the following Wednesday. And there'll be a homework assignment every week and it'll be about one page like this. And as of right now, I'll be grading all of them. And I haven't decided exactly, but the grading will probably be something like the following. If I can't read and understand your very, very clear answer quickly, you will get a zero, and then you have a chance of redoing it much more clearly and giving it back and getting full credit. So, because, you know, it's really painful, like, trying to dig your way through some horrible handwriting, confusing arguments and stuff. And usually there are very quick, easy answers, or not quick, but at least easy to understand answers to problems that I've written. So, also regarding working with other people, you're always encouraged to work together. Discussing the homework. It's really a good idea often to solve the problems yourself, but it's an extremely good idea to try to convince somebody else that your solution is right. I learned a huge amount in grad school, like watching and also arguing with people who I thought were much smarter than me, but then when I saw what they thought about my solution and mine was right and theirs wasn't, I realized that at the end of the day, you know, logic always wins rather than who thinks they're smarter. So let's see. Also, at 1:30 after the other class I'm teaching, so I'm teaching another grad class at 12:30 in the same room, but at 1:30 I'll typically go to lunch, probably over at McMahon, and if anybody wants to go to lunch with me at that time, they're welcome to, which could be a good extra opportunity to talk about the class. So regarding textbooks, so I've written up, so I've taught this course three or four times, depending on how you count, before in various forms. And I typed up notes when I taught it in the past into kind of a book form, and we'll somewhat closely follow that book, although you'll see even today things will be somewhat different. But you can get that book for free online, and there's the address for it right there. There's lots of problems in there, just read through it. There's also some nice notes by Milne on algebraic number theory from when he's taught that course at Michigan, which you can get online for free. And I personally learned, when I was a grad student, algebraic number theory from this. There's a book by Lane called Algebraic Number Theory. There's a book by Borovitch and Shafravich called Number Theory. There's a nice book called by Frolish and Taylor. It's not Richard Taylor, a different Taylor, called Algebraic Number Theory. There's a book by Marcus called Number Fields. This book by Marcus is horribly typeset and ugly to look at, but it has a large number of good problems and has a lot of information about how to kind of do by hand, I guess, computational stuff in number theory. So it's really, really good for examples, and in some ways much better for examples than any of the other books, even though it's... So the thing with that book is you might look at it and think, this is horribly typeset, I don't want to ever look at it again, but that would be a mistake, because it's actually well worth looking at. Then there's Castles and Frolic. This book is a book on algebraic number theory. It's a bit more advanced than the other books, but... that's probably the most important book of all the books here overall. since what it does is local and global fields, and they go on to do local and global class field theory and complex multiplication. They kind of do a whole range of topics. So that's an absolutely critically important book to get your hands on if you're going to be a number theorist. And there's also a book by Ireland and Rosen, A Classical Introduction to Modern Number Theory. And there's a lot in that book that is relevant to this class. Much of it's meant to be very accessible and doesn't assume as much algebra as I'll probably do. And there exist PDFs for all of these. In fact, if you go to the website for this course, so wiki.wstein.org, etc., then there's a link which says references, and I made a directory that has a PDF scan of every single one of these books, and it has a login and a password. And the login is 389, and the password is 5077 by two favorite prime numbers, right now at least. Although, so this is the first conductor of a rank 2 elliptic curve. This is the first conductor of a rank 3 elliptic curve over the rational numbers. Okay, so you should write that down, and that'll allow you to get PDFs of all these books, every single one of them. And there are, I mean, it's like 15 megabytes for all of them, so that's a little more useful than trying to find them in other ways. And some of them are ridiculously expensive if you try to buy them. Like Castle's Frolic is really expensive. Okay, so, although maybe that's changed since the Lenin Mass Society recently reprinted it with some corrections, which you should probably look for. Okay, so course goals. The number one goal in this course is to learn the proofs of several theorems, really. That's, if you look at any book on algebraic number theory, kind of the core content is proving a couple of theorems. And the main theorems are unique factorization of ideals in the ring of integers of a number field. I'm not assuming you know what I mean by what I just said, but you'll know what that means by the end of today. But basically, what happens is if you replace the integers, where you do have unique factorization, by the integers of a number field, so in other words, you maybe adjoin a root of unity to the integers and start considering numbers there, then unique factorization can fail. And if it didn't fail, then you could, for example, easily prove Fermat's theorem, just using cyclotomic numbers. But it turns out that unique factorization does fail. However, if you replace numbers by ideals, so instead of taking just a number, you take the ideal generated by the number, then you do have unique factorization again of ideals as products of prime ideals. And so we'll prove that you have this unique factorization. So it's just like in kind of elementary number theory, one of your fundamental theorems is, or the fundamental theorem of arithmetic gives you unique prime factorization of integers and the products of primes. You have something similar in Dedekind domains. And the proof we'll give, I think, will work in both rings of integers of number fields and also in an analogous function field context. So it'll work for an arbitrary Dedekind domain. And there are more Dedekind domains than just the ones that appear inside of number fields. So that's one big thing that we'll do. Another important thing is when you have a prime number, like 389, and you consider a number field, so Q adjoins some algebraic number, then you can factor, you can take the ideal generated by this prime number in the ring of integers of that number field, and you can factor it, because I just mentioned you can do unique factorization. So the question is, how does it factor? If the number field is a Galois extension of the rationals, then it has a very, very simple, there's some nice structural results about how it factors. Moreover, there are subgroups naturally associated to each of the primes lying over this prime in the number field called decomposition groups and inertia groups and higher ramification groups and so on. And there are also relations between these groups I just mentioned and Galois groups of finite fields and so on. So we'll establish those structural results. And then the final big result is finiteness of the class group and the unit group. So again, given the ring of integers of a number field, there's a way of associating to it an abelian group in a natural way, and it turns out that that abelian group is finite. And there are various approaches to proving this. One involves something called the geometry of numbers, where you embed, you basically do some geometry and out pops finiteness of the class group. An alternative approach is that you can realize the class group as being related to what's called the Edels, of a number field. And then you can use some topological result about the Adels that involves compactness and simultaneous compactness and discreteness, and then you get finiteness of the class group that way. So I think I'll give a complete proof of the first approach involving geometry of numbers, then I'll give a sketch of the proof involving the Adels, which give you two different intuitions for why class groups are finite. So those are the main theoretical goals. So by the end of the class, you'll know how to prove all of these results, okay? And if you want to, you know, like curl up for like 12 hours and read a bunch of algebraic number theory, those would be the proofs to read. That would prepare you very well. Okay, so that's one. Then the second is the objects of algebraic number theory, which just come up naturally in the course of discussing all of these proofs, like number fields, function fields, which are often important to keep in mind because some results are much easier if you replace algebraic numbers by polynomials. For example, Fermat's last theorem, which is very difficult in the integers, is very easy, or relatively easy, if you replace everything by polynomials and appropriately phrase it. And other statements, like the Riemann hypothesis, are much easier, still very hard, but easier in the sense that they're possible in the so far in the function field case. So we'll talk about those. We'll talk about a little bit about Adels and Idels. We'll talk about Galois cohomology groups. And I'll at least state the basic idea of class field theory and mention elliptic curves and local fields. But everything in part two, I don't make any claims. I don't give any proofs of anything. It's more that I want to introduce you to some of these objects because you'll see them later on in number theory. They provide good examples of where things are headed. So part one, complete proofs. Part two, no proofs or just very broad sketches of proofs. And then three is to learn how to compute with some of the above objects. Many of the objects I just mentioned, you can just sit there at the computer and just start working with them, or even computing by hand. But either way, you need to know something about algorithms in order to get anywhere. OK, so that's the goals of the course. Any questions? Any questions about the syllabus? How would everybody go around and say their name really quickly? And you have to say your name.
Fabiana.
Okay.
Andrew.
Matt.
Whoa. Alan. Amy. Cool. Okay. How many people are first year grad students? Cool. Okay. Four people. Great. Welcome to UW. All right, so the next thing we're going to do is, make sure everybody got their homework. Did everybody get a copy of this? So it's due next Wednesday. Okay, so what I'm going to do is start talking about number fields. And in particular, we're going to let K be a number field. And then we're going to define the ring of integers of K, and then prove that it is a ring. Prove that it lives up to its name. So let's let K be a number field. And this means the following. So K is a subfield of, well, for today at least, we're just going to fix that K is a subfield of the complex numbers. And it's finite as a Q vector space. So you can view K as a Q vector space since the rational numbers are a subfield of K. So you just, you know, view the elements of K as being given with a Q vector space structure. And then this dimension should be finite. And it's a fact that any number field can be written as Q adjoin, say, beta, or beta is a root of some polynomial, I'll say f of x in Q adjoin x, or Q square brackets x. So this means all rational functions in beta. It turns out that this is equal to Q square brackets beta, so you can verify. This means polynomials in beta. In general, if I write R square brackets X, I mean all polynomials in X with coefficients in R. And if I write R round brackets X, I mean all rational functions in X where the coefficients are in R.
This is always a field,
and this can be a field, but certainly a ring. So polys in X over R. And it turns out that if you take a rational function in beta, you can rewrite it as a polynomial in beta, and that comes from the dimension being finite. You can see this using the Euclidean algorithm, the extended GCD algorithm. You can take the denominator, and by using the Euclidean algorithm, you can find something that's equivalent to it, modulo the polynomial that beta satisfies. I think I'll save that for an exercise or talk about it later. Just put that as a parenthetical remark. We're not going to use that at all today. So the parentheses look confusing, so we'll just leave it like this. Okay, so that's a number field, and then inside of a number field, there is a subset, which I'll call, I'm always going to O sub the name of the number field. This is called the ring of integers of the number field, and it's the set of all elements alpha in the number field, such that alpha is a root of some monic, so leading coefficient 1, polynomial in Z adjoin X. So it's a root of something like X squared plus 5. It's not a root of something like 2X squared plus 5. So the leading coefficient has to be 1, the coefficient of X, the highest power of X. So it's a monic integral polynomial. And by the way, so maybe I'll make a little dictionary of definitions that I introduced, or will that kind of generalize some of these things. But so a number field, we define that. What is called, well, K will usually denote a number field. This really just means the dimension over Q of K is finite. Sometimes you consider them not necessarily with a fixed choice of embedding in C. That's just for convenience and concreteness today. And algebraic number, I didn't define over there. This is any root of any polynomial with coefficients in Q. And a number field happens to consist of Q adjoint some algebraic number. So any root of a poly in Q adjoint X. And then an algebraic integer definition is almost the same, but you require that the polynomial be monic and have integer coefficients. So an algebraic integer is a root of a poly in a monic poly, I should say. A root of a monic poly in Z adjoint X. So that's what an algebraic integer is. By the way, the statement that our number field, which a priori could have many different generators, is generated by one element, is known as the primitive element theorem, and it's true in a lot more generality than just this. What you need is a separable finite extension. But in the case of a number field, one easy way to see that this is true, if you know Galois theory, for example, is to know that there are only finitely many subfields of K that can between Q and K. So there's a whole bunch of intermediate fields here. However, there are only finitely many of them. If you take the Q vector spaces that you get, if you just consider all these finitely many subfields of K, and then remove them all from K, you've just taken away finitely many proper subspaces of K. Anything not in one of those proper subspaces generates K. Therefore, K is generated by one element. So this statement that every number field is generated by, there exists one generator, there exists a generator for that number field, follows just from the fact that there are finitely many subfields. And that isn't obvious either, but it is obvious if you, for example, know Galois theory, because there you can pass to the Galois closure, and then you know that the subfields correspond to the subgroups. There's an inverse correspondence that preserves inclusions between subgroups of the Galois group and intermediate fields. Okay?
So that's why this is true.
But it is true in more generality. There's a more general proof.
There are many proofs.
Question?
Yes.
Would you be correct in saying then that the integers of a k are the intersection of k and the algorithm?
Absolutely. Yes, or that.
By the way, if you take the collection of all algebraic numbers, that's called cube bar. So this is just a set of all of these things. And z bar, which is a subset of q bar, is the set of all algebraic integers. And then ok, which is a ring, though I haven't proved that yet, is equal to k intersect z bar. It's the set of algebraic integers that are in k. And now, the non-obvious thing about OK is that it's a ring. So, OK is a ring. And to show this, really, it amounts to showing that it's closed under addition and multiplication, neither of which is obvious. Just somehow, it's not quite obvious that if you take some number, like, I don't know, cube root of 17, which certainly is an algebraic integer, it satisfies x cubed minus 17, so it satisfies that polynomial, and you add it to, I don't know, fifth root of, I'll just put 389. That's another algebraic integer. It's not quite obvious what polynomial this satisfies, and moreover, that polynomial has integral coefficients and it's monic. I mean, in this particular case, we could work it out by taking this expression and raising it to larger and larger powers until hopefully we see something that, hopefully some large power of this is a linear combination of the previous powers. Maybe that would happen. We don't know actually yet, but it turns out it would happen. If we raise this thing to the power of 15, then we would see that it's equal to a z-linear combination of previous powers. That's what would turn out to be the case. But that's not obvious, and what the coefficients are isn't obvious, and how do we know that they're integers, and so on. But amazingly, what I'll prove next is that, in fact, this is an algebraic integer again. So we want to prove that this is a ring. And before proving this, I'm going to state a fact from algebra, which we'll come back to, and I'll sketch the proof of, or a proof of. But for now, I'm just going to make it a fact, and then we're going to prove this theorem using that fact. The fact is just the following. If you have a finitely generated abelian group, and you take any subgroup of it, it's finitely generated. Seems plausible. So any subgroup of a finitely generated abelian group is finitely generated. I mean, the basic idea is if you took z to the n, which is a good example of a finitely generated abelian group, and you took some subgroup, so you might define it by some, you know, theoretical construction that gives you maybe infinitely many generators, but countably many generators for the subgroup. The idea is that somehow if you just keep adding in new generators, after a while you can't keep getting a bigger and bigger subgroup. It's got to stop at some point and stabilize at the subgroup that those elements generate. It's not obvious. Even in the case of Z, there's already something to show. Why is a subgroup of the integers finitely generated? That's the same as saying you take an ideal in the integers, and you say, why can you always replace an ideal with maybe infinitely many generators by one with only finitely many? So for the integers, z, something you prove using, say, induction and the Euclidean algorithm, long division basically, is that the integers is a principal ideal domain, which is exactly the statement that every subgroup of z is generated by at most one element. And you could just generalize that using, say, Hermite normal form to prove this, just something similar. I'll come back to that if you feel it needs justification. But it's a standard fact from algebra. And I'm going to use this. OK, so now, before proving that OK is a ring, let's prove a lemma. Alpha is an algebraic integer, if and only if. So when I write alpha in z bar, I just mean alpha is an algebraic integer, i.e. I mean it's a root of a monic polynomial with coefficients in z. So that's if and only if the ring z adjoint, or z square brackets alpha, the ring of all polynomials in alpha, coefficients in z, is a finitely generated z module. Okay, so let's prove this. This lemma is just a nice, simple criterion for whether or not something is an algebraic integer. First, let's just do a quick check. Can anybody think of something that is in Q bar such that z adjoint alpha is not a finitely generated z module? 1/2. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, 1/2. If you take z adjoint 1/2, then what is that? It's polynomials in 1/2. So it's actually all rational numbers that have arbitrary 2's in the denominator. And that certainly isn't finitely generated as a z module. It's really, you mean, it's a very big, the z module, all right, but it's very, very big. It's just not finitely generated. It's generated by, just like Q isn't finitely generated for similar reasons. It's just not finitely generated. So this is not finitely generated. I'm going to start writing FG for finitely generated. So we can word of writing out. So this is not finitely generated, and in fact, 1/2 is not in Z. So that's a good sign. So now let's prove this. So it's really just there's a little trick, but it's basically a straightforward argument where you just think about each direction and use the definitions. Okay? So this will not be deep. So in fact, we're not going to use this fact yet. This is going to be an easy recharacterization of the definition. It's not a deep statement. So let's do the forward direction first. So we imagine that we have an algebraic integer, a root of some monic polynomial. We just want to show that z adjoint, or z square brackets alpha, is finitely generated. So alpha root of monic integral g of x. And now we just consider z adjoint alpha. So z adjoint alpha, that's all the polynomials in alpha with coefficients in z. Now, the thing is, this g is monic, so we can write g as x to some power d, where the coefficient's 1, plus a d minus 1, x to the d minus 1, plus dot dot dot, plus a1x plus a0, where those are all integers. And what that tells you is that, so the elements in z square brackets alpha, they're z linear combinations of powers of alpha, and notice that as soon as you see the power alpha to the d, since g of alpha is 0, g of alpha equals 0, that means that alpha to the power of d is a z-linear combination of smaller powers of alpha. This implies that alpha to the power of d is equal to minus some ad, or ai x to the, it's alpha to the I equals d minus 1 to 0, which is in z square brackets alpha, but it's more importantly, it's in the finite, it's in the group generated over z by the smaller powers of alpha. So I'll write group generated by 1 alpha squared all the way up to alpha to the d minus 1. In other words, z square brackets alpha is generated by 1 alpha squared up through alpha to the d minus 1. It's thus finitely generated. So, done. Okay, so again, this is finitely generated because it's generated by 1 alpha squared up through alpha to the d minus 1. That's the proof. One sentence of that direction. The other direction, you might think there's something difficult and clever, but it's actually just a little trick that's not difficult, clever, or deep.
Sorry, question. So
please.
Space one up to opposite d minus one and generate.
Yep. So z square brackets alpha, which is by definition all polynomials in alpha, is equal to the z module, not vector space, but z module generated by one alpha. Alpha squared up through alpha to the d minus 1, where d is the degree of g. And the proof is that if you imagine an arbitrary polynomial, you can always replace alpha to the d by something involving lower powers of alpha, and you could just repeat this until you finally have something that only involves lower powers of alpha. Okay? Great. All right, now the other direction, which is not obvious, but not deep, you can prove as follows. And it's really just, you think, what clever trick can I come up with? But then it's just follow the definitions in the most naive way it works. So the situation is that we have some alpha a priori in Q bar, and our assumption is that z square brackets alpha is a finitely generated Z module, which of course means that every element of this ring can be written as a Z linear combination of some finite list of elements of this ring. So let's just name the finite list of elements F1 of alpha. Remember, every element in Z square brackets alpha is a polynomial alpha. So F1 alpha, F2 alpha, dot F sub n of alpha. These are just polynomials in alpha, and they are a choice of finitely many generators of z square brackets alpha. So assume these generate. Okay, and that means that every single integral polynomial in alpha is a z linear combination of those. Now, here's the trick, which isn't deep. Let's just let D be one bigger than the maximum of the degrees of these finitely many polynomials. So let's let U F1 through Fn, so I can write degree, as polynomials, which we've substituted alpha into. And let's let D be the maximum over I equals 1 through n of the degree of f sub I of x. And then we'll add 1 to it. Okay, so I just took all the generators, maybe there's 1,000 of them, they have their polynomials in alpha and various degrees in alpha, and you just take one bigger than all the degrees that appear. Now the fact is that alpha to the power of d is in z square brackets alpha, right? It's just a polynomial of alpha. But every single element of z square brackets alpha is a z linear combination of these by our hypothesis. So we can write alpha to the d as a z linear combination, some, I'll just write some b sub I, f sub I of alpha, I equals 1 through n. And now, look at what I can do. If I consider the polynomial g of x equals x to the power of d minus some bi f sub I of x, this is a polynomial in z square brackets x. It's certainly monic because its leading coefficient is x to the d. I mean, its degree is d and the coefficient of x to the d is 1. This stuff all has smaller powers of x than x to the d. So this is monic, and just by how I constructed it, it has alpha as a root. G of alpha is just alpha to the power of d minus the sum bi f sub I of alpha. But these are equal to each other. So g of alpha is equal to 0. And that proves that That proves that alpha is an algebraic integer, which totally and completely proves this lemma. So we now have a characterization of algebraic integers. They're exactly the algebraic numbers, the elements of Q bar, that have the property that when you adjoin them to Z, when you go Z adjoin square, when you consider Z square brackets alpha, you get something that's finite as a Z module. And it's an if and only if condition. If you take, if some of these even slightly fails to be an algebraic integer, like a half, then this will not be finitely generated. So one way of thinking about algebraic integers is it's the roots of monic polynomials, a completely separate, but possibly useful, and we'll see very useful, way of thinking about them is that they're exactly the numbers that generate a finite module over Z. Okay? And I guess the algebraic numbers, you could view those as the elements of the complex numbers that generate a finite module over Q. It's another simple, just an analogy with this. I'll just make that a remark. So if you have if you consider alphas in the complex numbers, then alphas in Q bar, if and only if Q adjoin alpha, is a finite Q vector space, finite dimensional Q vector space. I'm not proving this, I'm just stating it as a remark. So for example, if you were joined, I don't know, pi, some transcendental number, to Q, then you get something that's not finite. And it also will not be a root of some polynomial. Alright, so we have this lemma, and now we want to prove the theorem that OK is a ring. And it's going to be an easy consequence of the fact and the lemma. So I must erase something. So I'll just erase this part of the proof. So the two things that I've kind of boxed here are going to very easily allow us to prove that OK is a ring. So if you believe that subgroups of finitely generated abelian groups are finitely generated, which you do, and you understood this characterization of algebraic integers, then you'll see that this follows very easily. And hence you'll believe this. So, proof of the theorem. Questions? Okay, so, proof of the theorem. So, we have to prove that OK is closed under addition and multiplication. So let's just take two elements, alpha and beta in OK. And our goal is to show that alpha plus beta and alpha times beta are both also in OK. So goal, alpha plus beta and alpha times beta are both in OK. Now, let me write down a module, or a ring. Consider the ring generated by both alpha and beta. So this is, again, by definition, all of the polynomials in alpha and beta. So to give an element here, you give a finite z-linear combination of powers of alpha and powers of beta. Now remember, since alpha is an algebraic integer, there's some degree d, so that alpha to the d can be written in terms of smaller powers of alpha. Likewise, there's some integer e, so that beta to the e could be written in terms of smaller powers of beta. And so, if you imagine an arbitrary polynomial in alpha and beta over z, if it has really big powers of alpha and beta, bigger than d or e, you can always just replace big powers of alpha by smaller ones, and big powers of beta by smaller ones, to get a polynomial in alpha and beta that has degree that's bounded. Basically, you can always make the power of alpha smaller than d, the power of beta smaller than e. Therefore, this is definitely finitely generated. It's generated by alpha to the I times beta to the j, where I and j are bounded by the degrees of alpha and beta. So this is finitely generated since, it's really visibly finitely generated, since it's generated by
I, alpha to the I, beta to the J, or I less than this B that I just mentioned, actually strictly less, and J strictly less than E. For here, just to be really concrete, alpha satisfies Pauli of degree D, and beta satisfies Pauli of degree E.
So we have our two elements, alpha and beta, and they generate a finitely generated module. So finitely generated module. I need to emphasize that because it's visibly finitely generated as a ring or as an algebra, but that's not what I'm talking about. I mean finitely generated as a module. It's a slightly different thing. This just means that Z square brackets alpha beta is a finitely generated abelian group. Now look, Z adjoint alpha plus beta is a subgroup, because certainly a group, and it's certainly contained in Z square brackets alpha beta, because certainly alpha plus beta is in here. Likewise, Z adjoint alpha times beta is a subgroup of Z adjoint alpha and beta. Conclusion, both of these are subgroups of this finitely generated abelian group, visibly finitely generated, because I just listed finitely many elements that generate it. So by our fact, which really just comes down to the Euclidean algorithm and the fact that the integers is a unique fact, is a principal ideal domain, we know that both of these are finitely generated. And that's where the depth of this entire theorem comes from. Everything is kind of easy except this one thing, that this module or this algebra, Z adjoint alpha beta being finitely generated as a module, implies that both of these are. But once you have that, then by our characterization of algebraic integers, you see that alpha plus beta and alpha times beta are both algebraic integers. That just follows because we know that these are both finitely generated. So let me just write something. Z adjoint alpha and beta is a finitely generated module. And inside of it, you have Z adjoint alpha times beta and Z adjoint alpha plus beta. So they're finitely generated modules. So both finitely generated abelian groups or modules. Finitely generated modules. And that implies that alpha beta and alpha plus beta are both in Z bar, which means that they're both in OK. And that proves that OK is a ring, that the ring of integers really deserves to be called a ring.
Question?
Yes?
Is there a cheap and easy algorithm for actually calculating the polynomials of the sum of two arbitrary alpha beta?
Not really. It depends what you mean by cheap and easy, but one of the homework problems, if you look at problem 2b, says, consider the sum of the square roots of the first n primes. Square root of 2 plus square root of 3 plus square root of 5 plus square root of 7 plus square root of 11 and so on. That's just the sum of a couple of algebraic integers, because the square root of a prime is an algebraic integer. Computing the minimal polynomial, the polynomial that's satisfied by this sum, gets extremely difficult as n goes to infinity. I think already for n around 12, 13, or 14, it starts getting very, very hard. Partly because the answer is enormous, as it turns out. The degree of the polynomial is 2 to the power of the number of primes. Since, basically, generically, when you add together algebraic integers, the polynomial that the sum satisfies, it's going to divide, but generically it will be equal to the product of the degrees of the polynomial satisfied by the two of them. So if you add together 20 square roots, you should expect generically that the polynomial they satisfy is degree 2 to the power of 20.
absolutely enormous.
So these are called Swinnerton-Dyer polynomials, and a good problem for computer algebra, like a test, is computing them efficiently.
If you look at the website for Sage Days in Leiden this summer, whatever number that was, this was one of their projects was writing code in Sage to compute these quickly. I think I read the fastest code using, I think, interval arithmetic and stuff. So, but you can take a look.
So
we've completely proved this theorem, and it's really important to understand the proof of this. So if you don't, ask questions. It's definitely understandable. It's not something that you can't hold in your head, I think, because it's really just a combination of this really nice characterization and this fact. And the fact, I mean, I really don't know. It's the sort of thing that you should see in another class, I think. But I'll just say some words about it as the hour ends. So there are various approaches to this. If you look at the textbook that I with the notes that I typed up that you see listed here, the approach that I take is to observe that the ring Z is Noetherian, which means that every ideal is finitely generated. So Z is a Noetherian ring. And then what I do is I prove the Hilbert basis theorem, which says that a finitely generated ring over a Noetherian ring is also Noetherian. And in particular, these guys are hence Noetherian, and from that you can deduce this statement. So one approach to this problem is to prove first that Z is Noetherian, then prove that finitely generated module or rings and modules over Noetherian rings are Noetherian, and then the condition, the definition of Noetherian is really just something that involves everything that you can define in terms of it being finitely generated. So that's a general commutative algebra approach to understanding this fact. But again, I want to emphasize that you don't have to know anything about Noetherian rings to get at this. Really, the key thing is just the Euclidean algorithm and its slight generalization in the form of Hermite normal form of integer matrices. And to think about that in my 1 minute, let's just imagine, to be very concrete, that we're... So just a quick remark. So if you have, say, a finitely generated abelian group G and a subgroup H, then since G is finitely generated, you can map Z to the N onto it for some N. Now, if you take the inverse image of H via this homomorphism in here, you'll get a submodule W. So W is just phi inverse of H. If you can prove that W is finitely generated, then its generators will generate H. So the problem of showing that a subgroup of a finitely generated group is finitely generated is reduced to the problem for Z to the N. And then for Z to the N, you can think entirely in terms of Hermite normal form, which is just the analog of reduced echelon form, but over the integers. And to be very concrete, you could imagine, for example, dimension 2. And once you understand that, I think the general case becomes very clear. So you have, say, countably many, but infinitely many different elements of Z2. So let's just see why, if you take the module generated by all of them, it's got to be generated by some subset of them, some finite subset. So you just take the module generated by the first one, and then you take the module generated by the first two, and you just keep taking the basis that you get and putting it in a reduced row echelon form, a row echelon over the integers. And what you'll get is that the first entry in your kind of echelon basis is going to be the greatest common divisor of all the first entries you've seen so far. And that can't keep getting smaller and smaller. At some point, it stabilizes. It has to, because it's descending, whatever, it's just basic crystal ball induction, I guess. So at some point, that stabilizes. And then you do the same with the second entries, and eventually they get down to some value, and they can't get any smaller as you keep reducing and putting in a sense, reduced row echelon form. And so at some point, every single new vector that you add in just gives you the same thing. You can't keep getting something that's smaller and smaller in the sense of the actual matrix that represents the submodule of Z2, the entries in it keep getting smaller and smaller. Okay, yes?
Is Hermite normal form the same as Swinnerton normal form?
No. Hermite normal form is just like reduced row echelon form. So it looks like this. You have entries down the diagonal, and then you have entries up here, but they're all smaller in absolute value. Entries on the diagonal that they're above, and you have zeros here.
Smith normal form is different in that you're allowed to do both row and column operations. And then we just get a diagonal matrix. So that's a little bit different. I'm just talking about Hermite normal form.
So H and F.
Also, if you look in the course textbook, there's a very detailed discussion of Hermite normal form and Smith normal form and so on. But again, this is the sort of thing you probably have seen in undergrad algebra classes, so I don't want to go into too much detail about that. Okay, so I'm done, and I'll see you on Friday.